Blog Talk Radio.
From Fairfax, Virginia, where it is a cold, well, you don't want to know how cold it is because it's going to get colder tomorrow. But this is your host, John Gresham, and Happy New Year. We're back for another year of Military Monday. And today's show is going to be about a somewhat warmer and, oh, shall we say, more dangerous place than Fairfax, if you believe the current readings. And that would be the Asian Pacific region. As those of you who are regular listeners know, we've done several shows on the ongoing problems and crises out in the Asian Pacific region, particularly the Air Defense Identification Zone crisis out in the East China Sea with Chris David Young a few weeks ago from the National Defense University. Well, today we have another author who has recently written a book about the growth of naval power by many nations out in that region. His name is Dr. Bernard Cole. Friends call him Bud. Bud, are you there today?
I am, sir. How are you?
We're good. We're good. And I'm just going to say this and get it out of the way. We're not going to hate you because you're in Honolulu, Hawaii today, on work, no less.
Well, in that case, I won't tell you what the weather is out here, John.
That would be wise, sir. We're getting a little crazy, and tomorrow it's going to be, I am told, all of 17 degrees here in Northern Virginia, so just don't. But what we do want to know is, tell us a little about yourself. I know you were a lieutenant commander in the Navy. What kind of service did you do there, sir?
John, actually, I retired as a captain in the Navy.
Oh, I'm sorry, Captain.
Surface warfare officer for 30 years, and during that time, I served 2 years and two tours in Vietnam, one with the Marine Corps, and I also commanded a frigate and a destroyer squadron, both home ported here in Pearl Harbor. And in fact, just about all of my service was in the Pacific.
Okay, and you left there. Obviously, somewhere along the way, you picked up a Ph.D. because you're now Dr. Bud. Tell us a little bit about your graduate work.
Well, in 1970, the Navy sent me to the University of Washington's Far East, what was then the Far East and Russian Institute, now the Henry M. Jackson School, to get a master's degree. And while I was there, I specialized in modern Chinese history, that is 20th century China. And then after another sea tour, I got a job as an ROTC instructor at Auburn University. And during that tour, I was able to finish my doctorate in modern Chinese history. My dissertation, which was later published as my first book, was titled Gunboats and Marines, the U.S. Navy in China. I then returned to sea and retired in 1995, and since then have been a professor at the National War College, which is part of the National Defense University. During that time, I've published another six books, almost all of them concerning either the Chinese military or energy security in Asia.
And just recently, you've published something brand new called Asian Maritime Strategies, in which you break down what it is that the various nations who have navies and are considered naval powers in the region are doing out there. And that's sort of what we're going to talk about today. What is the situation as we sit here today out on the rim of the Pacific and down through South Asia?
Well, the book that came out in October of 2013, Asian Maritime Strategies, is the third one of mine that the Naval Institute Press has published. And what I attempted to do in this was look at the Pacific Indian Oceans excuse me, and discern what the maritime powers were doing in terms of deliberate strategy In other words, not just counting ships and submarines and airplanes, but trying to figure out exactly what the nations themselves intended to do with their modernizing navies. And every nation in the Indo-Pacific is either actually modernizing their navy or talking about doing so.
And this is kind of an interesting point in a time worldwide which has had, for the past 5 or 6 years, mostly economic downturn, that in this cluster of nations along the rim of the oceans in Asia and in the Pacific, there's growth. There's actual maritime growth in both the size as well as the capability of their naval forces.
Yes, sir. The U.S. Navy, by a significant amount, is still the dominant maritime force in throughout the Asian waters, including the Indo-Pacific, which is a phrase I like to use. Certainly, the U.S. Navy is smaller than it was 10 or 20 years ago, but each individual platform is far more capable. The problem with that, of course, is that one ship can still only be in one place at one time, and the competition is increasing. The other key modernizing force, I think, from a naval perspective, has been the People's Republic of China, although I would still describe their modernization over the last 20 to 25 years as moderate in pace. I think that their goal and the U.S. goal are not at all similar, but that's something we can talk about as we go through a description of the different naval modernization programs throughout the Indo-Pacific.
And I think that we'll be talking more about China here in a few minutes. But let's go back to the United States, because a couple of years ago, almost 2 years ago, then the Secretary of Defense announced that we would be doing something that has been flagged by the press as the quote-unquote pivot to the Pacific, that we would reorient a larger percentage of our forces across all of the joint services towards operations in this Indo-Pacific region that you're talking about. Tell us a little bit about that move and how it's going so far and what the end goal is supposed to be, particularly from a maritime point of view.
Well, I think, John, that the rebalance, which is the word that we use now usually instead of pivot, is certainly far more than the Navy or even military in character. And I think what the administration was signaling was that since we are now drawing down our forces in Southwest Asia, specifically Iraq and Afghanistan, that we wanted to turn our attention or return our attention to Asia. We've never really left Asia. It's not a matter of going back to Asia. But I think it was just a signal that we were still interested in that region. Certainly the forces that were in Iraq and Afghanistan are not being transferred to Asia. And in fact, from a naval perspective, what the rebalance really amounts to, the idea that 60% of the U.S. naval forces would be in the Pacific Fleet rather than the Atlantic Fleet, reflects a process by which, as ships are decommissioned due to age or other reasons, they will be decommissioned from the Atlantic Fleet. It will not be so much an issue of transferring large numbers of ships from the Atlantic to the Pacific. In fact, as far as I know, during the past 2 years, the only additions to the Pacific Fleet really have been one aircraft carrier and three nuclear-powered submarines, the aircraft carrier being homeported on the West Coast, while previously it had been on the East Coast, and three submarines being added to our garrison, I believe, at Guam.
Okay. And how are we going to be distributing new production submarines and ships coming out of the yards on the Gulf Coast and the East Coast here?
Well, I have to assume that as these ships are assigned to home ports, they will be assigned in such a fashion as to maintain 60% of our naval strength in the Pacific Fleet as opposed to the Atlantic Fleet. Again, this is certainly a change. I don't consider it to be a particularly dramatic change. I simply think it reflects the obligations that we have under our treaty structure and where we see potential areas of concern around the world. We have to bear in mind also that we're certainly not abandoning the Middle East or Southwest Asia. And in fact, Pacific Fleet ships will still be assigned to the Indian Ocean, Persian Gulf, and so forth.
So the cycles of deployment that we've seen dating back to the Cold War aren't so much going to be changing as they're going to be more balanced towards the Pacific region, as you said.
I think that's true, but there is another side to the deployment pattern coin that is far more serious than any so-called rebalancing, and that has to do with the sequestration process. I realize that the recent congressional settlement has eased the sequestration burden a bit, but it certainly hasn't made it go away. And the lack or the decrease in operating funds for the Navy, and combined with a smaller Navy size, is going to have a significant impact on our deployment frequency. In other words, the loading on the ship's crews primarily, as well as on the maintenance plans for ships and aircraft. If we are going to continue to maintain the Cold War style deployment pattern, where, for instance, we always have two aircraft carriers in the Indian Ocean and or the Persian Gulf, as well as the aircraft carrier homeported in Yokosuka, Japan, it is going to really place an additional burden on crew time at sea, as well as on the maintainability of our ships and aircraft. So sequestration is really going to have the biggest impact on our deployment patterns to East Asia or anywhere else around the world. And it's something that the Navy, I think, is wrestling with right now.
Well, certainly we've been hearing a great deal around town here in the D.C. area about procurement personnel trying to buy fuel, food, all the things that were being held back, spare parts, whatever, during the actual sequestration, and get them into the pipeline for the Navy, for the Air Force and such, so they can at least come back to some level of operations approaching what things were before sequestration, or for that matter, the continuing resolution of 5 years ago. And let's talk now about some of those navies that are very active in building up their maritime forces, or at least intending to. You and I, when we were laying out the show a couple days ago, talked about four navies that you felt were sort of the top of the heap in terms of activity and the magnitude of what they're doing. And we're going to start with the big dragon, China. Talk a little bit about the People's Liberation Navy, if you will.
Well, John, the PLAN, as it's called, People's Liberation Army Navy, with the People's Liberation Army Navy Air Force, or Naval Aviation, was created about 1949-1950. But really, up until the mid-1990s, it was considered to be strictly a secondary service to the Chinese Army. Excuse me. And it, to a certain extent, it still is. If we look at the numbers in the People's Liberation Army, which is a term we use to describe the entire Chinese military, we find that out of about a 2.3 million person military, the Navy only numbers at the most perhaps 260,000 personnel. It may even be lower than that. The Chinese Air Force, about 300,000. So really, the Army still very much dominates in terms of numbers. What is even more significant is that as we look at the command structure of the Chinese military, all seven military regions, and China is divided into seven MRs, as well as almost all of the senior military positions in the People's Liberation Army, are in fact filled by Army officers, not Navy or Air Force officers. That said, beginning in the middle 1990s, particularly with the Taiwan Strait crisis in 1995 and 1996, Beijing has realized or seemed to realize the importance of a far stronger, modernized Navy in terms of defending what it considers to be its vital national security interests. So if we go back to 1995 or so, we find a concentrated program of naval modernization that we are now really seeing in full flower.
Now, this, in terms of day-to-day notice that people listening would find out in the media, it's normally seen in the form of new ships. They're building aircraft carriers. They're building lots of escorts. They're building amphibious ships. They've built a hospital ship. the things that a lot of people consider signs of a great naval power. What do you think of their building program, and how is it actually feeding into their capability as a naval power in the region?
Yeah, let me go class by class, if I might, John. The most significant building that they've done is in the class of conventionally powered submarines. If we go back to 2000, we find that they built over 30, and in fact, it's probably closer to 40, conventionally powered submarines. And I think they're doing concentrating on the submarines for a very specific purpose, which is a possible Taiwan scenario we can talk about here in a bit. In addition to submarines, of course, we have the single aircraft carrier, which the Liaoning, former Soviet ship, which is much more of a political statement than it is a sort of naval force today. But I think it does presage the fact that I think within the next 10 to 20 years, China intends building indigenously designed aircraft carriers, probably 2 to 3, and quite possibly nuclear-powered aircraft carriers. The reason that they have not previously built aircraft carriers, although the Chinese military press has been discussing it since the late 1970s, has to do with the strategic focus for which China has been modernizing its Navy. And I'll return to that in a moment. You also mentioned the construction of escort ships, destroyers, frigates, corvettes, and so forth. This is being done overall at a relatively moderate rate, I think. Within the past year, we have seen them focus on building more and more of these escorts. And I think to go along with their eventually planned perhaps 3 aircraft carrier groups. One way to look at this is that in terms of 21st century state-of-the-art escort ships, China still does not have more than 20, as opposed to the dozens and dozens that the U.S. or even Japan has. In fact, even Korea's escort force is probably a match for China's as we speak. Now, in the future, obviously, if China continues its current building rate, they will, within, I suspect, 10 to 20 years, certainly emerge as the single most numerous navy in East Asia, other than the U.S.
Okay. And with all of this building and all of this capability increase, what is it China wants to do with their naval power? What is it they want to protect, or what is it they want to control?
Well, John, that's really the key question. The reason I think they've been focusing on conventionally powered submarines is that the number one – well, let me back up just a moment. It seems to me that one of the reasons – the Chinese believe that one of the reasons the Soviet Union disintegrated in 1989 or 1990 was that from a military perspective, the Soviets tried to match the U.S. military sort of ship for ship, submarine for submarine, airplane for airplane, because they were concerned with a global – opposition or possibly a global war with the United States. Beijing, I think, has got a far less ambitious goal in mind. I think that China is focused from a military perspective very much on specific strategic objectives, the number one of which has been and continues to be today a possible Taiwan scenario. I don't think that the PLA is concerned about the Taiwan military opposition. It is concerned about U.S. military intervention, especially U.S. naval intervention, should Beijing decide to use armed force against Taiwan. Now, I hasten to add that I think the chances of that happening are increasingly diminishing, certainly since the present Ma Ying-jeou administration began in Taipei in 2008. But nonetheless, I believe China decided, particularly after the 1995-1996 Taiwan Strait crisis, that the best way to delay or prevent or perhaps defeat U.S. naval intervention in a Taiwan scenario would be to deploy 2 or more dozen conventionally powered submarines to slow down or perhaps prevent U.S. aircraft carrier involvement in the waters around Taiwan, hence the concentration on conventionally powered submarines. In addition to that, I think China is concerned primarily with what they refer to as the Near Seas or the Three Seas. That is the Yellow Sea, the East China Sea, which includes two disputed areas with Japan, and the South China Sea, which is a far more ranging dispute-intensive area. So these are the three seas that I believe Beijing considers to be vital national security interests to China. And hence they want a field, certainly by about 2020, I think, a navy that's able to defend their interests within these three seas. The potential conflict comes because of the fact that the U.S. has defense treaties with South Korea, Japan, and the Philippines, as well as a special relationship with Taiwan because of the 1979 Taiwan Relations Act, special relationship with Singapore, and a mutual defense treaty with Australia. So it's within these three seas that is the most likely potential area of conflict between China and the United States, certainly in maritime terms.
And is it not a fair statement? Certainly this has been something that several of your contemporaries have talked with on earlier shows, that conflict is bad for business, and keeping business good is the first and foremost goal of the People's Republic of China at this point.
Absolutely. You know, when President Xi Jinping of China wakes up in the morning, I'm pretty confident that the first thing he thinks about is not the United States or even Taiwan. But the first thing he thinks about is how many incidents of domestic unrest have occurred in China in the last 24 hours, and how is the economy doing today? As former Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill said, all politics is local. And so I think that China faces tremendous domestic issues, domestic problems that are very much on the mind of its national leadership, far more so than the maritime arena or our international affairs may be. Having said that, I think China is very concerned, China is very concerned about issues of national sovereignty. And, of course, Taiwan, as I mentioned earlier, I think is the number one in that category as far as China is concerned.
And, of course, we've watched a rather tense set of situations in both the East and South China Seas between Japan, Korea, ourselves, and the Chinese over the past couple of months. Do you see these, shall we say, stresses continuing and becoming something of a normal situation over the next year or so?
Well, I think the situation between China and Japan is the most serious right now. There's centuries of historic enmity between these two nations. The dispute in the East China Sea is really twofold. One is the dispute over seabed energy resources, and resolution of that has to depend on resolution of conflicting claims to continental shelf limits by Japan and China. And quite frankly, I think if we were both lawyers, we could easily disagree on whose continental shelf claim was most legitimate. There is a possibility of UN or World Court resolution of those conflicting claims, but neither nation seems particularly willing to submit the claims to international arbitration, especially China, which would always much rather deal bilaterally with such conflicts. The second dispute between Japan and China in the East China Sea is more serious, and that has to do with a series of five rocks and two or three reefs located just northeast of Taiwan. The Japanese refer to these rocks as the Senkaku Islands. The Chinese refer to them as the Diaoyu or the Diaoyu Islands. They're uninhabitable in the sense that there's no indigenous potable water on these rocks. The value that they imbue is primarily, I think, nationalism, although there is the chance of some seabed resources in the waters immediately surrounding. The dispute over the Senkakus or the Diaoyus has really been and remains today, I think, the most dangerous dispute in East Asia, other than, of course, the North Korea-South Korea thing.
Fair enough. Out to our listeners, if you wish to talk to Dr. Cole, please feel free to call in. Our call-in number is area code 347-945-7246. Again, the call-in number is area code 347 945-7246. Having talked about China, let's move on to the next nation on our list, Japan, or specifically the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force, because at least for the longest time, their constitution doesn't let them have a navy. They get to have a self-defense force, correct?
That's correct, John. And let me note before we talk, let me note that in talking specifically about Japan, as we look around the region, China, South Korea, India, Vietnam, so forth, that it's interesting that all of these nations' militaries are pretty much dominated by the army. That is not the case in Japan. If we look at the Japanese military, I'm not sure that we could claim the Navy is the dominant force, although I would not hesitate to say that, but certainly the Army is not the dominant force within the Japanese military. The Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force, which is for all intents and purposes a 21st century Navy, I think on a day-to-day basis is the most powerful Navy in East Asia. It maintains, it deploys Aegis-equipped escort ships. It is slowly moving towards conventional aircraft carriers. It has so far deployed two classes of what they call amphibious ships that are capable of operating helicopters as well as vertical takeoff and landing aircraft. It is now building a Marine Corps and all of that entails in terms of amphibious capability. It has modern conventionally powered submarines, and while these submarines are not as numerous as China's, based on my own extensive experience operating with the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force, I venture to say that there is no more professional or competent Navy in East Asia.
And this is a Navy that's working very hard on being capable in pretty much every warfare area, from surface warfare all the way to ballistic missile defense, correct?
That's correct. And what's even more significant, I think, at the national level is all during the Cold War, certainly, and really throughout the 1990s, Japan's defensive strategic axis, if you will, was to the north, based initially, of course, on concern about Soviet encroachment in Hokkaido, the northernmost Japanese island. A few years ago, and really very straightforwardly delineated last year, was the fact that Tokyo announced that their strategic defensive axis now was headed towards southwest. And they very specifically mentioned Chinese naval modernization as a threat that they wanted to confront. So they're very concerned about the modernizing Chinese naval and air forces, not just because of the Senkaku Daiyudai dispute or the East China Sea disputes, but because of the fact that Japan's trade depends so very heavily on the sea lines of communication that extend to the southwest, eventually through the Malacca Straits and into the Indian Ocean and to the Middle East.
As we all know, there have been two countries which have suffered maritime blockades and near strangulation or strangulation in the past 100 years, that being island nations, including England and Japan. And it would be irresponsible, to say the least, for the Japanese to ignore their own historic vulnerability of being an island nation, correct?
Absolutely. And in particular, well, first let me note that all the nations of East Asia are very, very heavily dependent on sea lines of communication, not just for energy, but for all their trade in general, and China for that matter, although China has the potential to be a little bit more independent of the sea lines of communications, simply because of the landmass and the natural resources it encompasses. But Japan is very conscious of this, and hence Japan is also very conscious of the Taiwan situation with respect to potential blockages within their sea lines of communication. As long ago as the heart of the Cold War, Japan, of course, has been concerned about the submarine threats to the sea lines of communication. But now that the Soviet Union is no longer a primary threat, Tokyo is now much more focused on a potential naval threat from China.
In terms of near and long-term movements and plans, what do you see the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force doing in terms of acquisitions and capability improvements. You obviously brought up the point that they're putting together a Marine Corps. They've got amphibious shipping. Talk a little bit more about the idea of them having some sort of fixed-wing, sea-based aviation capability, possibly with something like the F-35B Joint Strike Fighter. Take a run at that, sir.
Well, John, I think that that possibility is very real. In fact, I would be surprised if, particularly under an Abe government, that the Japanese didn't move to acquire the F-35. It's a very expensive aircraft. It's had a long delay, the initial operating capability, but it certainly has the flexibility that a nation like Japan might want for its small deck aircraft carriers. Let me note at a sort of higher scale, however, that for decades, the Japanese military budget has been informally capped at about 1% or below of GDP. Just within the last couple of months, Prime Minister Abe has announced a significant increase in that defense budget, and China has reacted really in almost an unbalanced fashion, criticizing that. In fact, when you look at the numbers that the Japanese government has proposed as an increase to their defense budget, it's still less than an additional 1%. It's not some really dramatic increase. It's significant in the fact that it's the first significant increase in many decades. And if the increases continue, if the Abe government remains in office and not the current trend in national defense concerns in Tokyo continue, then, in fact, we will see some significant increases in capability in the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force. Let me note here that the primary advantage, I think, in my experience, that the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force has had in terms of capability is not so much platforms, not so much submarines and ships and aircraft, as it is in the professionalism and the personnel expertise of its force. I think this is certainly intrinsically recognized in Beijing, and I often argue that certainly in the last decade or so, the most significant increases in Chinese naval capability have not been in new platforms. It's been in their improved training and accession of their officers and enlisted personnel.
Is it not fair to say that the Japanese have always tried to pattern themselves culturally in their navies, dating back to the times of the late 1800s, after the values and professionalism of Great Britain's Royal Navy, for that matter?
Well, I know that when Japan began modernizing during and after the Meiji Restoration in the late 19th century, they went about it in a historically unique and very laudatory manner. They looked around the world and they tried to decide, I think, based on my relatively minor knowledge of Japanese history, who was the best at various tasks, Germany, Great Britain, the United States, France, and they tried to import the appropriate technology. So I think that the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force throughout its history has reflected Royal Navy values and a systemic development and operational capability, much as has the U.S. Navy or any other former sort of British colonial navy. I remember being aboard a Bangladeshi frigate in the late 1980s and being amazed at how much like a Royal Navy frigate this ship appeared. Clearly, throughout world history, I don't think any navy has been more influential than the Royal Navy has. Having said that, the Japanese Navy has certainly continued to develop professionally and in terms of personnel capability over the decades.
And with that, we're going to take a quick break for some network messages. And when we come back, we'll talk about a couple more navies. This is Military Monday on the Right Stream Radio Network.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at RightStream and hashtag RightStream. Thanks for listening to the RightStream Radio Network.
Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the RightStream Radio Network, tune in to host Daria Ann for RightStream Tuesday. Daria Ann interviews talented authors in a variety of literary genres, from urban fantasy and historical romance To autobiography and science fiction, Write Stream Tuesday celebrates the creativity that flows through every author. It also delves into the all-important publishing and marketing aspects of writing, including the benefits and pitfalls of independent publishing versus traditional publishing, and how to effectively use social media for success. Write Stream Tuesday with Daria Ann. Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Write Stream Radio Network.
Hi, this is Lisa Tarvis. I'm a metaphysician, board-certified holistic health practitioner, energy healer, intuitive, and the author of the book, Just Believe. I'm also a host on the Write Stream Network. My radio show is called Just Believe and airs every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Please stop by my website at www.lisatarvis.com. That's LISATARVES. For details on all the services I offer, information on my book, and my radio show. There are many amazing guests and fascinating topics scheduled for the show in the upcoming months. I look forward to connecting with you soon.
Monday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Write Stream Radio Network. Tune in to Military Monday with host John D. Gresham, author, military historian, and journalist. John delves into a unique aspect of U.S. military history, as well as current events and issues affecting our men and women in uniform. Featuring exceptional guests, military experts and authors, Military Monday with John D. Gresham entertains, informs, and encourages listeners to support those who put it all on the line for freedom. Military Monday with John D. Gresham. Monday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Write Stream Radio Network.
And we're back. Are you with us still, Bud?
I certainly am, sir.
Well, good. Let's move on because there's a couple more navies we want to talk about here this afternoon. And the next one might surprise some people, but shouldn't if you've been reading the newspapers, and that is the Navy of South Korea. This has been a Navy which has actually been involved in combat. They had one of their ships blown in half by a torpedo from a North Korean midget submarine a couple years ago. They are actively involved in the current air defense identification zone crisis with China. And talk a little bit about their Navy and the rather unique set of circumstances they find themselves in going and applying maritime power to their national interests.
Well, John, the Republic of South Korea Navy, the ROK Navy, is a very capable force, both in terms of personnel professionalism and expertise, and in terms of the platforms they're building. In the last decade, they have put to sea several escort ships equipped with the Aegis missile system. They are now indigenously building conventionally powered submarines. Additionally, they have launched a large, what we would call a landing platform dock, or LPD, a large amphibious ship that is capable of carrying helicopters and potentially vertical takeoff and landing craft. They named that ship internationally the Dokto, which is the Korean name for a rock, a series of rocks they dispute with Japan in the Sea of Japan, or the East Sea, as Korea refers to it. That's a not very subtle message about their feelings about that disputed bit of territory. They're building a new naval base on Jeju-do, an island south of the Korean Peninsula. The primary concern for the Korean military generally, obviously, and this is a military, again, dominated by the Army, has been North Korea. It's got to be the primary concern because that's where the threat comes from, quite apart from the bombast and the nonsense that we hear announced in Pyongyang. There have been a number of incidents over the years in which North Korea has used military force against South Korea. The Cheonan, the South Korean corvette that was sunk by a North Korean submarine a couple of years ago, was only perhaps the most recent, most egregious such incident. But the South Korean military is really, it can never afford to be in a completely training mode. It has to always be ready to oppose a North Korean raids and intrusions into South Korean waters and into South Korean territory. I think this lends a great deal to the degree of professionalism we see in the South Korean Navy, another Navy with which I've had the pleasure and honor of participating on many occasions. The problem from a U.S. perspective is the historic enmity that the South Koreans, all Koreans, have felt toward the Japanese, based most recently on the Japanese colonization of Korea in 1905-1910 timeframe. A very harsh colonization that to this day affects the relationship between the two nations. What makes this particularly difficult for the U.S. is these are two nations with which the United States has defense treaties. And yet, as Secretary of Defense Hagel recently spoke to extensively during his tour last month of East Asian allies, getting the Japanese and the Koreans sort of on the same sheet of music in accordance with U.S. desires and priorities is not an easy task. Both nations do participate in the Rim of the Pacific exercise. The most, the closest one is going to be conducted this summer here in Hawaii, Hawaiian waters. But in the longer term, I really wonder whether the South Korean Navy is more concerned with future Japanese threats than it is with North Korean threats. It's something strictly my own supposition, but it's a thought that that not infrequently comes to mind.
I mean, certainly they have potential problems north, south, east, west, and we just saw, for example, the South Koreans react to the Chinese air defense identification zone expansion by expanding their own ADIZ south into the expanded Chinese ADIZ. This is kind of an interesting little multi-corner dogfight between the nations in that part of the world, correct?
Well, it really is. If we go all the way back to the 1920s and 30s, I forget who was a geographer called that a part of the world the cockpit of Asia, an area most likely to lead to conflict. South Korea faces two, I think, primary factors influencing its relationship with China, perhaps three. The first, of course, is the fact that the Chinese army can walk into Korea. It certainly can't do that with respect to Japan. The second fact, so that has to be, from a real politic perspective, that has to be much on the minds of any Korean strategist. Secondly, there's a very strong and increasingly strong economic relationship between China and South Korea. So there's an increasing stake that South Korea feels towards its relationship with China. And finally, historically, there have been links, both positive and negative relationships between Beijing and South Korea that must influence it. If we look at the recent South Korean reaction to the Chinese declaration on an ADIZ, we find, as you say, that South Korea sort of came back at Beijing and said, well, we're going to extend our ADIZ to cover this. There's a disputed submerged rock that the Western world calls Socotra Rock.
Rock never sees the light of day. It doesn't have water over the top of it, even at low tide.
That's correct. So in terms of the United Nations Convention on Law of the Sea, technically it's not even a rock, because a rock has to be above water at high tide, and it's certainly not an island. However, what the South Koreans have done, and they're not alone in doing this sort of thing in East Asia, is they built a platform on top of this submerged rock. So there always is this man-made structure above water. Having said all that, the South Korean reaction to the Chinese ADIZ declaration was relatively moderate compared to the Japanese and the U.S. reaction. And I think the reason the South Korean reaction was a bit more moderate was because of the strong economic and historical relationship and military situation that exists between South Korea and China.
In terms of South Korea's intentions, which I would say first and foremost is survival, given the potential problems they face, what do you see as their short and midterm goals in the next 5 to 10 years in terms of their developing their own maritime forces and using them?
Well, I think South Korea will continue struggling to maintain its number one or two position in the world in terms of commercial shipbuilding. We have to remember that the strongest commercial shipping concerns in the world or countries in the world are Japan, Korea, and China. Not necessarily. I think China's number one now, South Korea number two, Japan number three. So South Korea certainly will try to maintain a very strong commercial shipbuilding industry. In terms of its Navy, number one, of course, it's got to be concerned about North Korean threats and raids coming down to the south. It simply will not stand, I think, for another Chonan incident or even a shelling of one of the disputed islands in the Yellow Sea or the West Sea of South Korea, or Korea refers to it. I think that is going to continue as long as North Korea continues to exist and continues to behave as it has been in the past several decades. From a little bit longer term, I think South Korea is going to eventually, or if not already, be very concerned about Japanese possible threats from Japan. This has much to do with history. The only active territorial dispute is this rock I mentioned, which the South Koreans call Dokdo and the Japanese call Takashima. Again, there's no intrinsic value to these rocks other than nationalism, although, again, there may be some seabed resources around there that would prove valuable. So I think, as I often say, Korea is in a very, very tough strategic geographical position, surrounded, as it were, by North Korea, China, and Japan. It's going to have to maintain a strong military force to confront all three of these actual or potential threats. I consider North Korea to be an actual threat, Japan a possible threat, China more of a concern than an actual military threat from South Korea's perspective.
Okay. And let's go and talk about the last of the navies that we discussed a couple days ago, one that may surprise our listeners a little, and that's India. And you're saying, well, India's not in the Pacific. Well, yes, it is, and yes, it isn't. And let us not kid ourselves. The People's Republic of China and India do not play well together. And that's a long-term historic problem. Talk a little bit about that situation and what the Indians are doing with their Navy.
Well, if we go all the way back to Indian independence in 1947 and then the PRC being established in 1949, John, we find that Mao Zedong, who was then ruler of China, and Jawaharlal Nehru, who was then ruler of India, basically, really started off on a friendly footing. It was only in 1962, based over a dispute over some unoccupiable territory or unsettled territory in the Himalayas, where both sides employed military force, and China very definitely won a very short conflict with between the two militaries. Since that time, the borders have remained in dispute. There have been many, many conversations between Beijing and New Delhi in recent years, especially in a recent couple of years, attempting both to resolve this dispute or at least not let it dominate the relationship. Having said that, when one talks to the Indian military, I think one finds that, and again, this is a military dominated by the army, understandably, because the primary threat is usually felt to be from Pakistan, both a conventional military threat and a nuclear weapons threat. From Beijing's perspective, I don't think they believe that India poses much of a conventional military threat. I mean, the Himalayas are a hell of an obstacle, obviously. But India does have a nuclear inventory now and is continuing to design longer range and more capable nuclear capable missiles, which already have the capability of ranging China. So China is concerned about India's nuclear threat. More to the point of our discussion today, within the Indian military, the Indian Navy faces a very tough situation. Because of the army dominance, and India is concerned not as much with Pakistan as it is with Chinese naval incursions into the Indian Ocean. The Indian Navy in the last couple of years has been struggling mightily from a budgetary perspective within the Indian defense establishment to build a Navy that is capable and built around nuclear-powered submarines and three aircraft carrier battle groups.
Now, that's a very impressive thing. Even though they are one of the world's most populous nations, they certainly are not one of the world's per capita most prosperous nations, correct?
That's true. The Indian economy is having a lot of problems. I don't believe that the Chinese economists, for instance, consider that the Indian economy will ever overtake them. That's probably a dangerous assumption to make. But nonetheless, to date, certainly the Chinese economy is far outpacing in terms of development that in India. What's most significant from a maritime strategic perspective, I think, is that the Indian Navy has adopted, or New Delhi has adopted, two sort of general strategies. One is a look-west strategy, looking towards the Persian Gulf and sub-Saharan Africa. More germane to our discussion today is the look-east policy, in which India is attempting, I think, to become a power east of the Malacca Strait in the South China Sea. And evidence for that includes, in recent years, several deployments of Indian naval vessels all the way up to South Korea and Japan. There's two agreements with Vietnam, one of which allows Indian Navy ships to undergo maintenance periods in Vietnamese shipyards, and a second one of which has Indian naval personnel training Vietnamese submarine crews. Vietnam is currently acquiring kilo-class submarines from Russia. In fact, I think the first one just arrived in Vietnam. And another really strong indicator of India's look-east policy is the fact that they recently reorganized their Eastern Naval Command in the Andaman and Nicobar Islands, which are in the Andaman Sea, just immediately west of the Malacca Strait, raising the rank of the admiral commanding that naval command to vice admiral, from rear admiral. So India is very determined. Certainly the Indian Navy is very concerned about possible Chinese naval incursions into the Indian Ocean and is taking very definite steps to oppose such possible incursions.
It's interesting to note that this past weekend, China having recently shown pictures of their first quote-unquote aircraft carrier battle group, the Indians published their own picture of their own carrier battle group, but it had two carriers to the Chinese one. There is a certain amount of propaganda one-upsmanship going on between the naval forces of China and India, correct?
That's true. And let me make two comments, John. First, on the comparative basis between the two navies, the Indian Navy is one of those navies that I mentioned earlier that's strongly influenced by the old Royal British Navy traditions and so forth. And my interactions with the Indian Navy has engendered much respect on my part for the Indian Navy's professionalism and capability. The second point I'd like to make, which really applies to all the nations I've written about in terms of maritime strategies, has to do with the Indian Maritime Strategy, which was published a few years ago. It's very long. It's repetitive. Frankly, it's not very well edited. But I think it's aimed as much as a domestic Indian audience as it is at the Indian Navy or foreign navies. And I think this is common to all the published maritime strategies I was able to look at around the Indo-Pacific. It's interesting that as nations write these maritime strategies, particularly in these post-Cold War days, they have to be as much concerned with the domestic audience, with competition with the other services within their military, as they are with the effect on foreign forces, on foreign nations. And frankly, this applies to the U.S. maritime strategy as well as others.
Very good. Long term, if you were looking ahead 10, 20 years, what will the Indian Navy look like in your mind, and what will it be capable of?
Well, John, I think the Indian Navy will have its three aircraft carrier groups. It's going to finally have nuclear-powered attack submarines, and it will have nuclear-powered submarines armed with intercontinental ballistic, certainly interregional ballistic missiles, capable of reaching, obviously, Pakistani targets, but also targets within China. It's going to have a strong presence in the eastern Indian Ocean, and it will continue operating a strong Coast Guard, interestingly enough, which is a factor, a facet of maritime power we don't often consider, but that all the nations of the Indo-Pacific are very much aware of. That is, maintaining a strong Coast Guard presence to perform those missions which are not directly attributable to naval forces traditionally.
Very good. Well, we've kind of come to the end of the discussion about these four navies, and it's that time of the show where we ask, what's next for you, Bud? What are you working on now? Obviously, you're out in Honolulu getting ready to teach a class, but when they bring you home from the hellhole of Honolulu, what are you going to be doing, and what new projects are you working on?
Well, John, of course, our school year at the National War College goes until June, and I'll be teaching two classes spring semester, one on U.S. Pacific strategy overall, in which I'll have 13, 14 students looking at the U.S. strategy towards these various nations in East Asia. And also I've got a special working group that's working on South China Sea. Our students, we have about 200 students at the National War College, and they all travel each May to various parts of the world. And I have a group that we hope to take to China this coming May. But if we travel or not, we are working on this sort of what should the U.S. strategy development be with respect to all these competing claims we see within the South China Sea. Additionally, I'm working on a book that's got a historical perspective on Franklin Roosevelt and the admirals, taking a look at the relationships during World War II between President Roosevelt and the leaders of the U.S. Navy.
Excellent subject, and to say the least, some volatile and varietal personalities involved there.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be it's wonderful getting into the papers from Admiral Halsey and Admiral King and so forth.
Oh, you're lucky to have the time to do that. Listen, I want to thank you so much for coming on. I hope we can have you on again sometime. I'm going to keep you on speed dial just in case anything out in the East or South China Seas starts getting hot. And have a great time out in Honolulu. Travel home safe, sir.
John, thanks very much. Let me just reiterate that all these views today are my own and don't reflect those of the National War College or any other agency of the U.S. government. But it's been a real pleasure, and call anytime, sir.
Take care, sir, and have a great week.
Thank you. You too.
And with that, we've come to the end of another Military Monday. We will be back next week. We're working on a couple of new shows for you later in the month. I think you'll find them interesting. At least one of them's hopefully going to bring back one of our favorite guests. That's Dr. Tanya, the chiropractor who was talking about pain mitigation and management last year. We're hopefully going to have her talking about what you do when you come home from overseas, because this is the year America is coming home. For all of us here at the Right Stream Network, thank you, and we'll talk to you next week on Military Monday.
I took a flat to a pawn shop for a broken guitar. I took a flat to a pawn shop. How much is that guitar? I took a flat to a pawn shop. I got me that guitar. What's a flat in a pawn shop to me? I saw a man on the TV in a mask with a gun. A man on the TV, he had a 10-year-old son. I saw a man on the TV, his son had a gun. And he said that he's coming for me. I never loved a soldier. Never cherished freedom. Freedom never cried. Yeah.